Uncle Don here with the 298th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. On the 14th of this month, there'll be another sale of books surplus to the UNBC Weller Library. From 9 to around 2, you and Prince George have the opportunity to drop a few bucks and some interesting volumes while meeting Uncle Don in the flesh. Tables will be set up in the Agora at the foot of the library stairs. Come by and check this out. All proceeds go directly back to the library for acquisitions. It's your library, support it, and your insatiable reading habit. This coming week, we'll see a list released of some of the nastiest criminals in the United States has produced in a decade. No, it won't be a revision of the FBI's most wanted list. This will be the revelation of those chosen to receive Bush's parting presidential pardons. Act 2, Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution states that the president, quote, shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States. It's traditional for departing presidents to produce a laundry list of the forgiven. Some of George's may be those he considers to be wrongfully convicted, but he showed no sympathy as governor of Texas when sending multitudes of men to their executions. This right of pardon has been expended beyond the intent of the framers of the Constitution to cover immunity to those not yet charged or convicted. Expect the bulk of Georgians to be men who broke the law in service to their chief executive. Bush could, for instance, shield Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney from future charges of war crimes or crimes against humanity for promoting torture. It's even been suggested that George might attempt to grant himself immunity from future charges for the multitude of his own crimes. Fortunately, this power to grant reprieves and pardons will not protect any of his regime from arrest and conviction when not on American soil. Expect Bush's crew of henchmen and women to stick pretty close to home in the future. Pretty soon we won't have George Bush to kick around anymore, and vice versa. I heard that he won't just be cutting brush on his well-guarded ranch, but he'll also be working on his autobiography. Naturally, a literate ghostwriter will do the actual composition, while George will be left to color the pictures. I marvel at how a man of his mediocre talents managed to earn an undergraduate degree from Yale and an MBA from Harvard while reputedly in an alcoholic haze. Perhaps having a father who was head of the CIA helped. In any case, I haven't heard either Yale or Harvard using their illustrious alumnus as a recruiting tool. Here in Canada, we're stuck with a prime minister who hitched his wagon to the Bush star. In a week, Harper, known to Bush as Steve, will lose his protector and spiritual guide. There's an increasing rumble from within the Conservative Party that his time may be past and he could be pressured to set aside for a successor. Lucky, lucky Prince George may have an alumnus of UNBC in line for that post. James Moore, now serving as Member of Parliament for Port Coquitlam, is well-suited for taking over from Stephen Harper. James, although a bit on the porky side, could sweat that off, as did his leader. He has the same air of infallibility hanging about Stephen. He wears a suit with identical pomposity and could, I suppose, don a blue sweater and feed Chinese babies in the heat of an election campaign. What a shame it would be to see a coalition unseat the Conservatives later this month and relegate James Moore's rare talents to the opposition benches. Although a negative cannot be proven, just imagine that it were substantiated that there is no God. What differences would this make to our fragile world? Israel, bereft of a divine deed to ownership of Palestinian territory, would emerge as just another power-hungry nation expanded into land occupied by others. Palestinians and other Muslims would find the foundation of Sharia law gone. The entire Quran would be just another ancient book to be shelved next to the Torah and Bible, objects of study by obscure historians. Madrasas would have to begin real teaching, as memorizing their single textbook would be meaningless. Irish factions would lose a basis for their long-standing battles, as would Hindu Indians and Muslim Pakistanis. The entire batch of Christian fundamentalist Americans of the blue states would have to question the foundation of their opposition to progress. The Vatican would become a Roman museum, while its cross-dressed occupants could be occupied as tour guides. Some say that an absence of religion would bring on savage barbarity with all the faithful relieved of hopes of heaven and fears of hell. I think society would have to undergo some serious deterioration to be more brutal than it is now in the hands of various true believers. If we cease to live in thrall of the fantasy of an afterlife, humanity might find it behooves us to live for this life, treasuring our earth and valuing one another. Would we run amok absent faith in divine judgment? Maybe we'd fall back to the universal value of the golden rule. Just imagine a world environment where people and nations acted with consideration, treating others as we would want to be treated. Of course, this is just an idle wish. People will continue to believe in fantasies, killing, maiming, and exploiting one another in the name of any of dozens of true religions. Western observers are aghast as the Russian government is seen to be taking over the nation's energy business. But where were those concerned observers when the energy business took control of the United States government? It's just a thought. It's disappointing to see that even before taking office, President-elect Obama proposes massive tax cuts as a cure for the world's financial mess. Weren't Bush's rash tax reductions costing the U.S. Treasury hundreds of billions a year one of the reasons the U.S. saw a Clinton surplus become a multi-trillion dollar deficit? Did those cuts not leave the American government with no remedy for fiscal disaster other than further debt that will never be repaid? If Obama wants to stimulate his economy, he could do no more for it than pour money into the strata of the economy where benefits are spent, not saved. He could house the homeless, feed the hungry, educate the ignorant, treat the sick, pumping money in at the bottom where it would rise. Trickle-down economics of the Reagan era is a failure. Trickle-up is a proven stimulus. A long time ago in a land far away, Washington, the District of Columbia to be exact, a senator made a widely ridiculed statement. Everett Dirksen said, "A billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money." A billion was once a number held in awe and seldom heard. Now it rings through every news report as businesses report losses in the billions and governments hand them goodies in the hundreds of billions. Some years ago, millionaires were considered rich. Now they're thick on the ground, even as the ranks of homeless grow. I understand that among the rich, one is not called a millionaire unless his annual income is in seven figures, while those with mere accumulations of a million are considered among the hoi polloi. I recently picked up a book copyrighted in 1984, wherein a protagonist was a big-shot auto company executive. His salary was an astronomical $200,000. These days, his earnings would pass that figure sometime in mid-January. Not just that, but his tax rate would be far lower than that of the man who made just a fifth of a million in those days. I mentioned before my brother's executor had an American tax form for 1949 framed on his wall. It was a single two-sided sheet. On one side was to be listed income, with proper deductions yielding a figure for net income. The reverse had a schedule of percentages of that net income to be remitted to government. The top rate, beginning at $250,000, was 92%. In those bygone days, it was expected that the wealthy would pay a larger proportion of their income to the government, which did, and does, disproportionately protect their class. What has happened to our money? Why has actual inflation accelerated much faster than officially declared rates? The answer is one of the simplest in basic macroeconomics. The real value of money is linked to the total goods and services available for purchase. When money becomes less scarce, relative dollar prices will rise. The supply of money, at least the share produced by central governments, is controlled at one end by printing presses and on the other by taxes. Cutting taxes which siphon money out of circulation has the same effect as printing more money. For past months, the money supply has been vastly inflated from both ends of the pipe. Tax deductions and reductions are called tax expenditures by economists. Remember that our central government doesn't need your money. They could easily cancel all taxes and carry on printing ever more. This has been done by Zimbabwe. The result there is a rampant inflation and a government cranking out billion-dollar bills not worth their paper. It's much easier to inflate the supply of money than to contract it. A government that cuts taxes is a hero, and one that increases them is a villain. Economists are scared spitless that our credit disaster could lead to deflation, the dreaded situation where prices and wages enter a downward spiral as money supply decreases. Its antidote is inflation, and we may have that affliction coming in spades. Even Jim Flaherty, the man who swore there would be no deficit in any budget on his watch, advocates running a massive negative balance this year. Conservatives will reduce taxes while spending more. Neither the Liberals nor NDP would do otherwise. Obama promised huge tax reductions in the first 2 years, cuts even larger than the massive ones produced in the Big W's initial half term. Bonds sold to collect funds for governments to spend, an alternative to just running the presses, are considered money by their holders. Someday those bonds must be redeemed in real money. Where will that cash come from? Chickens will come home to roost. When, or if, the world's economy recovers, it will have an awful hangover of government debt and excess money to deal with. Can any Democratic administration brave the wrath of its citizens by increasing taxes and closing loopholes to suck up that extra money and quasi-money? As one who lives on a fixed pensions and savings, I fear the fiscal hangover should politicians find it easier to allow inflation to erode the value of all that extra money. Many millions, like me, could find ourselves with lots of money that will buy little. Everyone in Zimbabwe is a millionaire, but do we envy them? Since the big power blackout a few years ago, wherein a fault in Ohio shut down much of eastern Canada, there's been a movement for an all-Canadian electricity grid. Such a hookup would allow the vast hydro potential of Quebec, Labrador, and British Columbia to supply provinces now relying on filthy technology, notably coal burning. This Trans-Canada power grid proposal makes a great deal of sense, but only for the benefit of Canada's people, not necessarily its private corporations. The problem with using those hydro resources is that they're controlled by Crown corporations. The idea of allowing publicly owned companies to expand offends right-wing ideologues in Harper's regime and its like-minded provincial allies. Their response has been a push to commit Canada's electricity supplies through long-term foreign contracts so they will not be available for a potential cross-Canada network. Hydro-Quebec is negotiating with New England states on a contract that would tie up a good part of their capacity and export obligations for a full 20 years. Our own provincial guardian, Gordon Campbell, is promoting a contract with the U.S. that would likewise oblige us to provide electricity for many years. With such commitments in place, we couldn't assure a stable supply of power to our eastern neighbors. Campbell also mandated Hydro to procure additional electricity from so-called independent power producers. These private entities tap public streams and rivers, selling the generated power to Hydro at prices higher than the public corporation wholesales it to industries at home and in the U.S. This is a transparent means of lowering BC Hydro's profits, so it will have to increase domestic rates. When those rates are high enough, a future government will be able to convince consumers that the Crown Corporation should be sold to a private company with the promise that it would be more efficient. Public power companies, like all other publicly owned assets, are being softened up for turnover to the private sector. If we allow contracts like these to go ahead, we're on track to give up all semblance of control over our own economy. During the Vietnam War, President Johnson sent a flood of soldiers into his faltering occupation, calling it an escalation. The ultimate failure of this escalation led to the retirement of the term, as it was perceived to be tainted. George Bush increased the number of soldiers in Iraq not with an escalation, but with a surge. His surge has temporarily smothered the violence with soldiers, but it's clear that his pet war is coming to grief. Enter an influx of 10,000 more American soldiers into Afghanistan in an effort to stop the spread of resistance victories. This will be neither an escalation nor a surge. This batch of soldiers will represent a troop uplift. I welcome suggestions on terms for military increases in future wars. Get out your thesaurus and see what you can come up with. We can stray pretty far from words actually describing these increases without being more euphemistic than uplift. The good news is that American soldiers will be ending their occupation of Iraq. The bad news is that Barack Obama has pledged to leave behind a teeny tiny residual force. This wee itsy bitsy contingent will be tasked with fighting terrorism, training the democratically constituted domestic Iraqi forces, and protecting American citizens. Richard Danzig, Obama's designated security advisor, estimated that 30,000 to 55,000 soldiers will be required for these tasks. This will assure American stewardship of Iraq indefinitely. The intent is permanent occupation. As for the chore of training, it's reminiscent of the role of the original special forces in Vietnam. advisors in title, warriors actually, they paved the way for an escalation of several hundred thousands of common soldiers. And what about this protection of U.S. citizens? Tourists, perhaps? No, these will be the thousands of corporate employees charged with the job of extracting Iraqi oil. They may need a lot of protecting from an outraged Iraqi public watching their natural resources being siphoned to a foreign enemy. Residual force indeed. Watch for a huge occupation of Iraq forever, or until their oil is safely exported. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. The New Year's first weekly newsletter from an analyst in New York contained the following comment, quote, "Standing in the way of immediate response is the enormous debt load the globe is carrying. Savings rates worldwide are at historically low levels. No matter how low interest rates go, you cannot incentivize capital to be spent where it doesn't already exist. National debt and personal debt are the single largest impediment to sustained economic growth," close quote. Canada's finance minister, Jim Flaherty, just made the following statement, quote, "We've had discussions about ways in which we could accomplish the goal of making sure that commercial paper market works. The number one issue that I've heard so far across Canada has been access to credit, access to financing, and the issue about commercial paper and securitizations is one part of that," close quote. Flaherty, the man who foolishly stated not long ago there would be no budget deficit on his watch, has now seen the light, promising the budget will plunge into deep deficit and our national debt will expand drastically. One day, commentators may refer to these as financial homeopathic remedies, based on the hypothesis that like cures like. All acknowledge that credit is the problem, so credit is the solution. Taking a long view, it would seem the rational approach to our financial ails is a drastic winding down of credit in society. Not in the economy, that amorphous conglomeration, but society, human society. Trained economists, among whom is our prime minister, view the monetary economy as a pivot about which society revolves. As the world's climate deteriorates and resources, especially energy resources and food, become scarce, we'll be forced to change our focus. Sooner or later, we must unwind all of this debt overhang. We will return to the days when business operated with retained earnings and households saved for their needs, needs which must be satisfied sustainably and short of the extravagances we see today. The long-run goal is clearer than the short-term. The transformation will be painful. Henry Ford built up his auto business without debt. His successors became enamored with the idea of leverage, magnifying profits by using other people's money. That works well on the upside, but on the downside, as we now see, is disastrous. Leverage by business has to go to the way of using home equity for security for frivolous buying of junk and services. Drastic spending cuts required for retrenching will cause massive job losses. Prevention of a popular revolution will mandate a redistribution of wealth. No longer will the wealthy live high on the hog from unearned income. No more McMansions, no more Caribbean holidays. The economy will have to take a back seat to society's needs. There will come a time when lifestyle, leisure, and family will be central to our pleasures as we are stripped of our ability to acquire all of those toys and activities we're used to. That's the pleasant picture, one of shared pain to bring about a new world of greater equality. The alternative is that we follow in the path of Chile under General Pinochet, where the wealthy take control of government by force. Few of my listeners would welcome this, but Bay Street would love it. The power is in our hands to make sure that we come out of this fiscal chaos with a more egalitarian, democratic society. Restructuring will not be a national project. International cooperation will be necessary to avoid violent clashes. Society can no longer afford the waste of war and preparations for wars. I see why political leaders are opting for today's Band-Aid approach, patching our flawed economic system. Actual cures will be so drastically disruptive that no one wants to take the heat from making real changes. Better to limp along with more of the same than face the hard restructuring that will have to come someday. As for me, I may not live long enough to see the piper paid, but I think that those who are in today's students probably will. Lots of luck to you all. 22 years ago, my wife and I bought a new Toyota pickup truck. Over the intervening decades, we've given it hard use, hauling wood and trash, pulling unfortunates from ditches, and bouncing across Prince George's notorious potholes. Side panels on the bed rusted off. The bed itself developed holes large enough that I couldn't carry bricks without losing some. The whole bed was finally replaced with a fabricated flat deck. A rubber mat covered a rusted hole in the floor of the driver's side. There was not an undented panel in sight. Still, it ran well. Finally, my wife refused to drive this rolling wreck, and last weekend we bought a replacement. What to do with the old one? I asked the salesman what he would give me for it, and he offered a hug and a kiss. This might have appealed to my wife, but it did nothing for me. That night, we drove our poor old truck to her sister's farm, where we traded it for 3 dozen eggs. She offered 2 dozen, but we drove a hard bargain and got the whole 36. My late brother was unburdened with spouse, so he could drive a vehicle that no wife would have tolerated. He once had an old wreck of a truck, on which he finally gave up. He bought another wreck in better condition, then drove the old one to a junkyard where he traded it for a hubcap to fit the newer one. I can't let this show pass without railing about the invasion of Gaza. Yeah, I know. This is just a defensive action on behalf of beleaguered Israel under rocket attack from Gaza. I won't talk about the whole huge disproportion between the alleged provocation and Israel's response, nor would I go into the 100-to-1 casualty rate between the two sides. You've heard plenty on both already. What captured my attention was an article announcing the creation of an Israeli institution they call the National Information Directorate, now some 8 months old. The function of this outfit is Hasbara, Hebrew for explanation. As you may have guessed, the explanations manufactured by the Information Directorate involve vast amounts of distortion, spin, propaganda, and pure bullshit. The NID claims success in getting its version of events, even quite indefensible events, into the world's news media. Not that these media needed much prodding. They fed us pro-Israel propaganda for decades, ever since the new nation was established on Palestinian land, Jewish land, as the deed was handed to them by God Almighty. But I digress. The NID carries 3 prime messages at this time. Hamas has not lived up to ceasefire agreements. Israel's actions are solely in defense of its people. And Hamas is a terrorist organization. Too bad about the turkey shoot underway in Gaza. That's the way it goes when a nation is defending itself. No one seems to be asking whether the Hamas government in Gaza condones the firing of rockets and whether they have the power to control those firing them. We're not to ask what outlets for frustration are available to a people jammed into a small, crowded land, surrounded by another nation keeping inhabitants captive. What are they to do when that other nation limits imports and exports, impoverishing them all? When even emergency rations supplied by the United Nations and Red Cross are violently cut off? This propaganda may work to sway casual observers in foreign lands, but it won't get through to Gaza residents who are being bombed, shot, and terrorized. You don't achieve peace by tormenting an enemy and killing its people. The Israelis should have learned this when the Nazis surrounded the Warsaw Ghetto and attacked its residents in actions eerily mirrored in Gaza today. Schadenfreude is a word I see in print a lot lately. This word of German origin refers to the satisfaction or pleasure felt at someone else's misfortune. It's commonly used these days when referring to those who foresaw the collapse of credit markets protecting their assets. But some of us feel the sense of Schadenfreude while watching the unfolding of a rolling disaster, which is the preparation for the 2010 Olympics. Even when the NDP government backed Vancouver's bid for this event, many of us foresaw a huge mess. Every bid made by a city for the honor of hosting these Olympic parties is promoted with great promises of forthcoming prosperity. It will put the city on the map, bringing future tourists and investment. Then come the disruptions, the cost overruns, and finally the lost income to individuals and small businesses as traffic becomes jammed and spending is diverted from normal commerce. Montreal incurred an Olympic debt decades ago, which has just recently been paid down. Athens is stuck with massive debt and a crumbling accumulation of useless venues built for their Olympics. London has now won the right to hold the 2012 Olympics there and now wonders how to finance them as the world credit falls apart. So I feel schadenfreude as I watch what is happening in Vancouver and Whistler. This is tempered, of course, by the knowledge that massive costs of the party will eventually be carried by you, me, and everyone in our province, the city of Vancouver, and our whole nation. The ill-conceived Athletes' Village in Vancouver is a case in point, where ego, hubris, and rosy thinking combine to get the city and Hawk for the better part of $1 billion. This white elephant of 1,100 units on prime land was to house jocks for a fortnight, then be converted to condominiums and sold for a profit. Since the commitments were made, property values have fallen, demand for fancy digs in this monstrous beehive have collapsed. The foreign contractor has lost financing, while costs have escalated, as should have been foreseen and accounted for. It's questionable whether the project will be completed at all unless the provincial government steps in with more of our tax money. There aren't many who will pay $10,000 to $20,000 per square meter for a unit when competing accommodation is available for a fraction of that price. After the party, this building may stand empty as a monument to stupidity. For decades, the city of Vancouver has ignored the black hole of its Lower East Side. As long as the homeless, the junkies, and assorted losers were kept contained and away from the prosperous, who cared? With hordes of tourists due next year, there's a sudden interest, not so much in solving the problem, but in covering it up. There is an aspect of homelessness that is seldom addressed. With a mobile national population, we can expect that any jurisdiction providing accommodation for the homeless will see an influx of more homeless from other areas to take advantage of it. Thus, the problem is a national one, while solutions fall under provincial jurisdiction. No city wants to foot the bill for transients from other areas. So Vancouver is left with a conundrum. If they house the homeless, they will draw more from across the nation. If they don't get them off the streets, they'll be seen by tourists who will be revolted. The solution is to remove these unfortunate from sight while not doing it in a way that attracts others. It seems that they have a plan to do this. Invoking the Mental Health Act, BC Housing Minister Rich Coleman proposes to remove transients from city streets for their own good. In order to do this, officials will have to define the behavior of street people as indicative of mental illness so they can be hauled off and protected temporarily out of the public eye. The minister's concern will be fleeting, concentrated on the time of the Olympics, and then fading rapidly as the tourists depart, leaving the Lower East Side and its denizens again to rot quietly out of the public mind. This concluded the 298th Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Join me next week for a celebration of George Bush's exit from 8 ignominious years as leader of the free world.